across the vast open fields and the rolling downland of the Arras battlefields of 1917, we find a small, possibly insignificant looking village. But here, in the great battle of that year, the men of the Royal Naval Division won this ground at high cost. Here was their altar of sacrifice, Gavrelle. We're back at Arras for this episode of the podcast, the second time this series we've come to this part of the old front line. It often grieves me, really, just how under-visited the battlefields around the northern French city of Arras are. It's an accessible battlefield, as we've discussed before. You can get to it from the Channel ports or the Channel Tunnel in around about an hour. And there is so much Great War history there that doesn't just span the British and Commonwealth involvement. That's only half the war, from 1916 when the British first took over until 1918 when Canadian troops broke through the Hindenburg Line, the Drocourt-Queant switch line, the DQ line, and advanced on Cambrai. And then in the previous 2 years, in that first half of the war, this is a French sector of the Western Front. And there's much evidence of that throughout the sector around Arras. So lots to see. And it's no accident that we've returned again in this season to these battlefields around Arras, having visited Henin Hill and that part of the Hindenburg Line sector around Arras right at the beginning of this season six. So where are we on those Arras battlefields? We're east of the city on a piece of high ground close to the fast road that runs from Arras itself up towards the A1 Lille-Paris motorway. And this bit of ground, known as the Pont du Jour, the Break of Day, is a piece of high ground that was so critical to the British advance here in 1917. When we study almost any battlefield of the Great War, we discover how important high ground is. In flat Flanders, those low rises really turns the whole war there into a battle for the possession and repossession of that so-called high ground. Here around Arras, as with the Somme, it's rolling chalk downland, and that downland will give any defender an advantage. And for a big chunk of the First World War, up until when the British took over this sector leading up to the Battle of Arras in April and May of 1917, it was the Germans once again who had that advantage of high ground here at Arras, having taken the high points at Notre Dame de Lorette to the north of Arras, which the French wrestled from them in 1915. They'd taken Vimy Ridge to the northeast, which during this Battle of Arras, as we discussed in quite a few previous podcasts, would be taken by the Canadian Corps. And all round the city, this rolling landscape meant that the Germans had utilised that landscape as part of their Hindenburg Line defences to create positions that would dominate the ground. And here at the Pont du Jour, a position that was some way behind the actual German front line, it overlooked the approaching ground. So even if that German front line was taken by the Allies, then this would be a fallback position with good fields of fire, good visibility to defend. Now, where we're starting this walk, and I'll put a map on the podcast website, it's at a point right on the Pont du Jour where, up until about 15 or so years ago, there stood the memorial cairn to the 9th Scottish Division. This was the very first division in Kitchener's army raised in 1914, following the formation of the New Army, as the official title gave it. The 9th Scottish Division was part of the so-called First 100,000, the first 100,000 men who had enlisted as volunteers. And we discussed the whole aspect of volunteers with Richard Van Emden in his new book in a recent podcast. And if you've not listened to that one, you can go back and have a listen. And his book is highly, highly recommended. And the 9th Scottish Division is really kind of the epitome of what those volunteers were all about. So this was one of their battles of the Great War, one of their greatest achievements, as we'll discuss. And it became the place for their divisional memorial. They were a unit, because of their volunteer nature, they had a very good old comrades association after the war. And That is a link, as we've said before on this podcast, between the publication of a divisional history, in this case there was one for the 9th Scottish Division, and the erection of a divisional memorial, which was placed here. Now, we're standing here now, and the bit of ground that sits between this fast road, which is a kind of a dual carriageway, is still there, but the 9th Scottish Division Memorial is not. It's further back over the Pont du Jour, right alongside the Pont du Jour Military Cemetery, a British and Commonwealth cemetery of that name. Now, we're not going to visit that today, that cemetery, or the new placement of that memorial. That's, as we often say here, that'll be a story for another day. But I've come here because this is where it originally was. And every time I pass this in a coach or a car, or if I'm walking in this area, I kind of look over to this. It's still here, that little patch of ground. The monument is not, as we've said. But I can't help feeling a kind of sense of a loss, because the memorial was not placed here by accident. It's right on one of the objective lines of the division during that April 1917 fighting. And there was a bit of Great War archaeology here. There was part of the German trench system alongside the memorial. And a decision was made all those years ago, because of the volume of traffic that passed through here, I think the idea or belief that they were going to create almost like a motorway that would go through here to link up with the actual motorway, that the memorial and the site would be under threat. So understandably, it was moved to another location. But the trench was just kind of bulldozed over and lost, and that Great War archaeology lost along with it. So it is with some sadness in that respect that we begin our walk here, thinking back to when this was a really interesting site to visit, and all of that is now gone. The 9th Scottish Division is one of those important formations in the First World War, and we've often come across it in this podcast. It had a South African brigade by 1916 because it had been so badly chewed up during the Battle of Loos in 1915 that one of its Scottish brigades had been disbanded and replaced by the South Africans. Those South Africans had been commanded in their first battle at Delville Wood by Brigadier General Lukin. H.T. Lukin was a South African officer, and we've discussed his career and his men in that battle for Delville Wood on the Somme, again in a previous podcast. But by this time, by this stage of the war, by 1917, he'd been promoted. There was a new brigade commander in the South African brigade, and he was now the divisional commander. And I think possibly in the 20th century, the first time a South African officer achieved this kind of rank. Now, he was a good commander. He was not one of these chateau generals. He'd proved that at Delville Wood when he was in the thick of the fighting there. And he meticulously planned his operations, and this attack here at Arras in April 1917 was no exception. He had quite a wide front on his part of where his division would go over the top on the 9th of April 1917, the opening day of the Battle of Arras, with all three of his brigades up. So they were up in the front line and they were all going to be making an attack. Normally you'd have two brigades in the front line and your third one behind to act as a reserve. But for this battle they were doing things slightly differently. The whole division would advance and another division, in this case the 4th Division, would be behind them and they would then leapfrog through. So rather, as had been the practice on the Somme, where battalions leapt through battalions, perhaps brigades leapt through brigades and continued with the advance as the battle tactics on the Western Front changed and adapted and things were learnt from the conditions of the Somme fighting in 1916. At this battle, it was entire divisions leapfrogging through another formation, thousands of men continuing with the advance. And the idea was to break through this front and advance as far as possible into the ground beyond, to push the Germans right across the open ground beyond the Pont du Jour and hopefully break the line here around Arras as to the north. The Highland Division and the Canadians were attacking that ground just to the south, or actually on Vimy Ridge itself. The whole plan of leapfrogging such a huge volume of troops was not the only unusual part of this battle. Brigadier General Tudor, who was the Commander of Royal Artillery, the CRA of the 9th Scottish Division, had planned the bombardment here to reach its maximum potential, and not just to destroy German positions. This became one of the lessons of the Somme, to use your artillery to pulverise the German trenches, cave in their dugout entrances, entomb the defenders, smash up strong points. But you also needed smoke, and here he decided to put 1 in 4 of the shells as smoke shells, so that the troops, when they advanced on the morning of the 9th of April 1917, would be protected by smoke. Now, this was against the orders of not just the Corps, but the wider army under General Allenby, who commanded this sector during the battle here in 1917. And Tudor had to kind of sneak this under the radar, not that that phrase obviously existed in the First World War, but he had to sneak this under the table so that they didn't notice. And they decided to carry on with this approach by putting these smoke shells in there, irregardless of what anyone else thought. And this proved to be a good tactic. And as I say, it kind of mirrors the lessons, particularly in terms of artillery and the way artillery was used, that had been learned at such high cost on the Somme the previous year. And when General Lukin looks at his divisional objectives for his three brigades that would make their attack, in front of him there were three objective lines: the black line, the blue line, and the brown line. Now, these colours don't really mean anything. It was just literally colours, lines on a map to distinguish the first, second, and third objective. And it was a way of informing the troops as to what their objective was. This was the beginning of a period of change when ordinary soldiers were briefed much more about the battle they were going to take part in, because that was linked to the successful outcome of it. And we see that reaching a pinnacle with the Canadians using it on a widespread basis at Vimy, some units here in other parts of the Arras sector, and then on a bigger, much bigger scale with Messines just a few months later in June of 1917. And these three objective lines were essentially the three main system of German trenches that extended across this ground and up and over the Pont du Jour. So where we're standing on this high ground of the Pont du Jour, we are on the brown line, the final area of objectives for his men, and close to the boundary with other formations, and on the ground captured during the fighting on the 9th of April 1917 by men from the South African Brigade. And once they were here, the 4th Division, so this was a regular army division that had been out since August 1914, very few regulars still left serving in it by this stage because of all the casualties and the many battles that it fought in, but this unit would then pass through them and continue with the attack beyond this ground towards the village of Gavrel, which can be seen from the top of the Pont du Jour, and over to the right towards Fampou, and beyond that a chemical works in and around the village of Rueix. All of that was part of what was known as the Green Line objective. Now, as the attack went in, the battle went pretty well for Lukin's men. The trenches had been so badly damaged by Brigadier General Tudor's bombardment that some German positions and machine guns had been overlooked. They'd been pulverised, the Germans had dug themselves out of these positions, and they'd not been properly mopped up. So Germans did fire into the rear of some of the advancing troops, machine guns opened up, but they were then cleared by mopping up troops. So this leapfrogging meant that as one unit moved forward, others followed up, and they then cleared the ground. The mopping up side of any attack was again part of the lessons learnt in those battles on the Somme the previous year. The final objective here around the Pont du Jour was reached, but it was thick with uncut wire. And one of the units that came up alongside the area where the South Africans were advancing was the 11th Royal Scots. In the Royal Scots regimental history, they record that with such an obstacle in front of them, the wire, even a few men could have held up a division. But the enemy had been stupefied by the swiftness of our advance and the loss of his strong forward entrenchments, and made no serious attempt to stem the rush of the Royal Scots. While the Jocks were laboriously threading their way through the maze of uncut wire, they could see in the distance scores of Germans bolting in panic-stricken terror towards the east. With the Pont du Jour and the Brown Line captured, units of the 4th Division then passed through the South African positions here. The 1st East Lancs, the 1st Hampshires are two of those regular battalions that were part of the 4th Division that continued with the attack towards that green line, so-called green line. And this was a division, these were men, battalions that had been worn down by that terrible fighting on the Somme in 1916, which the division had been involved in from the very beginning, with an attack on the 1st of July right through to the battle in the mud in the autumn of that year. One account stated that the 4th Division was commanded by Billy Lambton, a charming man, though unapproachable in the early morning. This division had had a hard time. It had lost its spirit and gone stale with weariness, and General Lambton was given a new set of brigade commanders to pull it together. One of those brigade commanders was Brigadier General Adrian Carton de Wiat, VC, who had won his Victoria Cross, been awarded his Victoria Cross for bravery as a battalion commander at La Boisselle in the early stage of the Somme fighting in July 1916. He was a real fire eater, and I've told the story before of a veteran that I knew very well, George Butler, in the machine gun corps in this division, encountering de Wiat's in no man's land on the evening of this first day's attack on the 9th of April 1917, de Wiat being out with his staff on patrol right at the epicentre of the battlefield where the fighting was. So again, he was no chateau general. So what we see with the 4th Division is quite a successful advance beyond the Pont du Jour towards this next stage of the German defences. So the 4th Division is pretty successful, but it doesn't take every objective. Fampoo on the right is taken. The approaches to Rueix, they hold fast in a series of sunken lanes and positions just east of Fampoo village there. But Gavrelle, just on the other side of the Pont du Jour, is not taken in that early stage, and that would be an objective as the Battle of Arras continued. So as we stand here on the Pont du Jour, look over across this ground, this vast open landscape and these rolling downland around Arras towards Fampoo, Rueix beyond, we can see the motorway in the distance, and beneath us the village of Gavrelle. We're looking at a bit of ground where the largest single advance in the British experience of trench warfare took place on the 9th of April 1917. When we add the advance of Lukin's Scottish Division to the 4th Division that passed through them, it's 3.5 miles into enemy territory that they take that day. A 3.5 mile advance. I mean, that is kind of light years compared to what had happened the previous year in Picardy. So this is an important battle. And as part of the recognition for their success with the 9th Scottish Division, Lukin's men were collectively, as a formation, awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal, the DCM. Now that didn't mean that every man in the division could pin that ribbon on his tunic or wear the medal, but it meant that as a division they'd been recognised in this way. And Lukin decided to back the symbol of the division with the ribbon of the DCM, and the men could wear that on their tunic. And I have one or two contemporary postcards where you can clearly see this for men who were stationed in Germany at the end of the war and very proudly kind of walking around with this distinction on their uniform. So what we're going to do in this walk is not just stop and stand here at the Pont du Jour and look at everything from a distance. We're going to get out on the ground. We're not going to Fampoo or Rueix today, but we're going down the hill towards Gavrelle. And what we've seen here with the history of the fighting on this spot, the opening phase of the battle on the 9th of April 1917, is the establishment of this part of the front and then the ability to continue with that battle towards Gavrelle. And that's where other formations come into the story, and we'll discuss them. So we're going to leave this position here, walk alongside the fast road. It's not a brilliant place in reality to walk because of the nature of the ground. There's no footpath there, but in our virtual walk, we're going to walk parallel to this road and then down into the village of Gavrelle, and that'll be our next stop. As we come down the hill here towards Gavrelle village from the Pont du Jour, we can see quite a lot of modern industrial units on our left-hand side. There's been a lot of that kind of development around Arras in recent years, and it has involved and resulted in quite a lot of Great War archaeology. The bodies of men from the Lincolnshire regiments, almost certainly the 10th Battalion, the Grimsby Chums, were found here, and subsequently their bodies, although not identified, were reburied in Pont du Jour Military Cemetery just up the road. So once again, this part of the battlefields continues to give up its history. That last page of the history of the Great War once more will never be turned in places like this, as developments result in archaeology and archaeology results in the discovery of physical remains, of positions and trenches and artifacts, and also human remains. And that great wheel of the history of the Great War keeps on turning and keeps on turning, and hopefully always will. As we walk down the hill towards the village, we pass a demarcation stone just on the side of the road. And this is one of a number in the Arras area, one of, 120, I think it is, or something along the whole Western Front. It's a Vautier stone. He was the architect that designed this. We're well overdue for a podcast about the demarcation stone, so I won't say too much more about them now. But this one marks the point, the nearest point at which the Germans got back towards Arras following the fighting here in 1917 and their attempt to break through this front in the spring of 1918, which we'll discuss a bit more when we're down in Gavrelle village. But following the path into the outskirts of the village, we immediately come to a site connected to the Great War. Just to the left of a little side road here is a damaged brick wall, a battle-damaged brick wall, it's what it symbolises, with an anchor in the middle of it. And an anchor, a full-size anchor, an obvious symbol of the Navy. And this memorial commemorates the men of the Royal Naval Division, officially the 63rd Royal Naval Division. Now, this was a formation that came about in 1914 when Winston Churchill was Lord of the Admiralty, and he realised that he had more sailors than ships to put them on, so he came up with the idea of forming this infantry formation out of naval personnel. He grouped together Royal Marines from Portsmouth, from Chatham, from Plymouth and Deal, together with 8 battalions of Royal Naval Volunteer Reservists, each of them named after an admiral. So there was a Nelson Battalion, a Hood Battalion, Hawke, Collingwood and so on. And they then served at Antwerp, in the area around the Antwerp forts in Flanders, in October 1914. Then they came back to Britain, to Blandford Camp in Dorset, reformed and went off to Gallipoli, served throughout the Gallipoli campaign. Quite a lot of the naval units suffered such high casualties there that they were disbanded. And when the division finally came to France in the early part of 1916, some of those naval units were replaced by army ones. And then the division served on the Somme and in almost every battle of the Great War right up to its final conclusion. It was attached to the Canadian Corps in some of the final battles on the Western Front, and its men were in action, for example, on the morning of the 11th of November 1918 on the flanks of the Canadians just south of Mons. Now, there is an official Royal Naval Division memorial at Beaucourt on the Somme. That's where their old comrades association decided to erect their divisional memorial. But there was nothing commemorating them here as such. And in the 1980s, a group of Great War enthusiasts that included people like Carl Tallett and Trevor Tasker, who would go on to write a Battleground Europe book about Gavrelle, which is highly recommended, and I'll put a link to that onto the podcast website. This group of enthusiasts got together, some of whom had been involved in the construction of the memorial to the 38th Welsh Division, the Red Dragon at Mametz Wood, and decided to place this memorial here to commemorate the men of the Royal Naval Division. And so this is a modern memorial. This is not placed here by Great War veterans, although there were some veterans of the division still alive when this was placed here. And the ruined wall symbolises the destroyed village of Gavrelle. The anchor is the obvious symbol of the Navy. And then around it are the badges of the different units that serve within the division. Royal Marines, Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve, those battalions named after admirals, and then the army units that were part of the division by 1917. Units like the 7th Royal Fusiliers, the 28th Londons, the Artists Rifles, the Honourable Artillery Company, and several other army units. And although it retained its naval title, its naval status, it did have army units serving within it. So the memorial was designed to commemorate all of these. And it's kind of gone up and down a little bit in its fortunes in recent years. Money, I think, was put aside for its maintenance. It had a bit of an overhaul during the centenary, but it still looks a little bit tired occasionally when I come here. I'm never entirely sure if the people of Gavrelle really want or wanted this memorial. Perhaps sometimes we build too many of these things, but it's good to see these lads from the Royal Naval Division on a really important battlefield for them, as we'll discuss, being commemorated with a memorial like this. So what of the story of the Royal Naval Division in the battle here in April of 1917? With the establishment of the line in this sector after the attack right at the beginning of the 9th of April, the second phase of the advance here took place on the 23rd of April, when the division attacked with both some of its army and naval battalions towards the village itself. Its barrage that protected its men and neutralised the German positions they were assaulting was pretty successful, and the battalions fought their way through the German trenches into the ruins of Gavrelle village. When the battle began, much of Gavrelle was probably still intact. A church tower might have been brought down, some of the taller buildings, but it was pretty good condition and had been behind the German lines. Now, being on the front line for a few weeks, it had been ground down by the British bombardments and reduced to rubble. But the German defences to the west of the village, facing towards Arras, were taken, and the men of the Royal Naval Division then fought their way through that rubble of the village. And one of those was Joe Murray. Joe Murray was another Great War veteran that I had the privilege of interviewing. He's left quite a legacy of his war behind with two fantastic books, one about Gallipoli, one about his service on the Western Front. The Imperial War Museum oral historian Peter Hart interviewed him as well, and he appears in quite a few of Peter's books on Gallipoli and the Somme and so on. And he left this quote about the battle at Gavrelle in April 1917. When we got into the village, it was different. Jerrys were in cellars and we were in the open. And by then it was quite light, so we were perfect targets. In the village there were bricks flying about, rifle and machine gun fire. You couldn't keep in any formation. Sometimes you got under a half blown down house, and other times you got over the top. The wire in front was piled up in heaps, as it usually was by an artillery bombardment. We had to keep gathering together to get past a particular place. However, you couldn't climb over the 10 to 15 feet of bricks that had formed. I remember as we got to the first objective, it didn't seem too bad. We seemed to be organised. But when we got on to the second objective, a road that runs through the village, oh dear me, there was no line and no sort of direction. You couldn't see any officers and you couldn't see any men. Sometimes there were three or four together, and sometimes you were on your own, wondering where everybody had got to. And what we get there from Joe Murray's account is the confused state of fighting in an urban area, fighting in built-up areas, as it would be called now. This was something that the British Army in the First World War had not really trained for, and their approach to it when they were faced with it on a battlefield was often a little bit ad hoc at best, which we see in the experience of these men of the Royal Naval Division here on the 23rd of April 1917. But despite these problems, by the end of the day, the village of Gavrelle was in the hands of the units of the Royal Naval Division. The ground to the north towards the neighbouring village of Oppie with its wood, Oppie Wood, had not been taken, was still held by the Germans, so that formed a flank to the north of the village, still in enemy hands. But the positions were consolidated and the village of Gavrelle was held. And there was a pause in operations for the second phase of the Royal Naval Division assault here, which would take place on the 28th of April 1917, and largely involved men of the Royal Marine Light Infantry, which we'll talk about later on in this walk. But as we continue to walk into the village, we come up alongside the Mairie, the town hall, and on the wall of the town hall we find a plaque to the men of the Queen's Westminster Rifles and their action here in March of 1918. So who were the Queen's Westminster Rifles? They were a pre-war territorial battalion, 16th Battalion of the London Regiment, and their pre-war headquarters and drill hall was alongside that of the 14th Battalion of the London Regiment, the London Scottish, in Horsefree Road within Westminster itself. And they had come out to France in the autumn of 1914. They'd taken part in the Christmas Truce in December of that year, and they'd served in quite a few actions around Ypres and on the Somme here at Arras and then again at 30 Passchendaele in 1917. So by this stage, by March of 1918, they were quite a veteran battalion, but of course many of its original members long since been killed, wounded, discharged, transferred, commissioned, or whatever. So there was a very high number of conscripts, as was common in almost every battalion on the Western Front at that stage of the war. The action that they fought here in March of 1918 was a defensive battle against the German advance here, which was part of their wider spring offensive of that period of the war. With the imminent arrival of the Americans, the Germans had gone on the offensive on the Somme on the 21st of March, breaking through the defences there and then here around Arras to try and push the Allies back. Eventually they would continue that with Flanders in April, Chemin-des-Dames in May, and then on the Marne in June of July of 1918. All of those German offences would fail with heavy loss, but it would push the Allied line back, inflict heavy losses on the Allies, but it would result in the German army quite literally shooting its bolt and being unable to continue really as an effective fighting force on the Western Front. And the Allies, with superiority in numbers and tactics, equipment and weaponry, would defeat the German army in that final phase of the conflict. But that was yet to come. Here at Arras in March 1918, the Germans were trying to regain that ground that had been lost to them in the Allied, the British advance here in April 1917, and perhaps do more than that and break through on this part of the front. And battalions like the 16th London Regiment, the Queen's Westminster Rifles, stood in the way of this. The front line that they defended and the battalions that were part of the wider 56th London Division that was holding this part of the line at that point were in trenches to the east and northeast of Gavrelle with trench systems there, but quite a few outposts. The line was kind of very heavily anchored in these outposts, and this was a common practice at this stage of the war for the British in terms of kind of defensive policy, to have these outposts or redoubts to secure your position with strong points in the machine guns, lots of ammunition, and if the Germans broke through the trench system, you would use these outposts or redoubts to inflict heavy losses on their advance, and hopefully your battle reserve would be called up and counterattack and push them back. And the 16th London Regiment, the Queen's Westminster Rifles, had taken over these trenches and outposts in the lead up to when this German offensive, this German attack would come in. And when they relieved a unit that was in the line here, they found quite a few men missing from the different outposts because the Germans had raided them and either killed them or taken them prisoner and taken them away. So this was a kind of portent of doom that something big was about to happen. And that something big took place on the 28th of March 1918, just a couple of days after they first moved into the line here. There had been some warning as well from a captured German prisoner who'd spilled the beans that a German attack was upcoming. But that was pretty clear when this huge bombardment mixed in with a lot of mustard gas that was dropped onto the London positions clearly indicated the Germans were coming at them hard and that they were intent on breaking through on this part of the front. The positions defended by the Queen's Westminster Rifles were heavily bombarded and hit by the mustard gas attack, and obviously their men suffered under the strain of that. But on their flanks, their neighbouring battalion, the 5th London Regiment, the London Rifle Brigade, was pretty much wiped out, and their garrison, in particular around the site of the Gavrelle windmill just to the north of the village, was devastated by this fire. The Germans then pushed even harder in their attack, and gradually the trenches and the outposts collapsed under the weight of this attack. However, despite the loss of ground and the loss of positions in defending these outposts and using the tactics that they had, the men of both these units, despite their losses as well, were able to inflict heavy loss on the German attacks from these outposts with machine gun fire and calling in artillery fire and trench mortars as well. So the Germans paid a high price for the ground that they took around Gavrelle at that time. And it also saw both battalions carrying out a controlled withdrawal over this ground. So it wasn't the case that the Germans attacked, overran the trenches and an outpost and the men legged it. They were fighting, giving fire, suppressing the enemy, causing casualties, and then carrying out an ordered and staged withdrawal, realising those positions could not be held indefinitely. And again, when you think that these were really conscript battalions by this stage of the war, handfuls of non-commissioned officers, warrant officers and officers who'd come up through the ranks and been promoted because of their experience in previous battles, but the majority of the men doing the fighting were young conscripts, 18, 19 years old, it's quite remarkable for a battalion of that kind of nature to be able to pull this orderly withdrawal off. And I think it shows how good the British Army training was at this period of the war. This wasn't a case where they were just sending men into battle as sheep going over the top and getting annihilated, that the British Army had gone on top of its training, and that was reflected in the way that it fought its battles on the ground. So although the Germans took Gavrelle in March of 1918, they were stopped just to the west of the village. We walked past that demarcation stone earlier, you remember, which marks the limit of the German advance. And it's there the men of the London battalions, and the Queen's Westminster Rifles amongst them, stopped the Germans in the wake of their advance and stopped them from continuing towards Arras itself. And the position to the north, Vimy Ridge, which had been taken by the Canadians in 1917, was one that was occupied by British troops, and the dominance of that overlooking this northern part of the Arras battlefield also helped with the defence of this ground during that March 1918 period. So the German attack here, rather than giving up all of the ground and the Germans breaking through as they had done on the Somme and marched on Amiens, here at Arras they were stopped. Losses on both sides, some ground given up, but they'd not broken through. That was the most important factor here. So the plaque on this town hall here at Gavrelle remembers the Queen's Westminster Rifles, the 16th Battalion of the London Regiment, and states, in glorious memory of those who fought at Gavrelle, 28th of March 1918. After the war, it was very common for places in Britain to twin with communities and villages and towns here on the old front line. And the city of Westminster adopted Gavrelle post-war, which led to this memorial plaque being placed on the Mairie, on the town hall. From here we continue into the village. And of course in 1917 this was just rubble. Joe Murray described the kind of conditions as they'd fought their way through the village. And of course that only got worse as the rest of the war continued. And by 1918 villages like this around Arras were just dust, just brick dust, a smudge in the mud where a village had been. So everything that we see here is a post-war rebuild, and that's typical with all of these villages in this area. As we head towards the rebuilt church, we can go inside and we find another memorial, a much earlier memorial, to the men of the Royal Naval Division. Now, not the whole division. What we've got in here is a memorial cross, a wooden memorial cross, to the Hood Battalion, one of the battalions within the division, known as the Hood Battalion Cross. And this was a cross that was placed on the battlefield at Gavrelle by Lieutenant Commander Arthur Asquith in 1918, done at his own expense to commemorate these men who had fought and fallen here in the battles of 1917. This wooden cross, still here on the battlefields, is a rare survivor. Now, the name Asquith might be familiar. Arthur Asquith was the third son of H.H. Asquith, who had been the Prime Minister in the first 2 years of the war, and was the brother of Raymond Asquith, who had been killed with the Guards on the Somme in September 1916 and is buried at Guillemont Road Cemetery on the Somme battlefields. Arthur Asquith had served in the Royal Naval Division since the very beginning in 1914. He'd fought at Gallipoli, been awarded the Distinguished Service Order for his bravery there in the battles at Gallipoli, and took over the command of the Hood Battalion from Bernard Freyberg VC, that popular battalion commander who'd been awarded the Victoria Cross for his bravery on the Somme in 1916 on the eve of the attack at Gavrelle. Asquith then went on to be wounded at Cambrai and lost a leg following his action there, dying in 1939. He's a very important figure in the history of the Royal Naval Division, but one of the forgotten Asquiths. Most people, if they talk about Asquith and his son, they think there's only Raymond, and poor Arthur Asquith was somewhat overshadowed by the death of his brother in the battles of 1916. So this cross, as it states, is in memory of the officers and men of the Hood Battalion. It's got a carved Hood Battalion badge on it, and it lists many of the fallen by name. The church isn't always open and it's hanging on the church wall, but well worth going into to see this rare battlefield survivor, this battlefield cross that's still there. There's quite a few that came home subsequently that are in barracks or churches or other locations, but to have one here on the battlefields in an area that not many people come to and don't casually come across, it's a rare memorial to go and visit and well worth doing so. There's no memorial to them here, and we've spoken about the army battalions in the Royal Naval Division, but one of those who fought very close to where we are now is the 1st Battalion Honourable Artillery Company. Now, despite its name, Honourable Artillery Company, it wasn't an artillery unit. It was actually an infantry battalion. It had two infantry battalions in the Great War, and it did also have some artillery as well, which makes it even more confusing, I guess. But here, they were an infantry unit, and they were part, one of the army battalions that were part of the Royal Naval Division, and one of the officers in the battalion was Alfred Oliver Pollard. Born in 1893, he joined the ranks of the Honourable Artillery Company at the beginning of the Great War, been awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal at Ypres in 1915 as an ordinary soldier, then been commissioned and been awarded the Military Cross as an officer for bravery on the Ancre in 1917 during that coldest winter of the war. And then he was subsequently awarded the Victoria Cross for his bravery here at Gavrelle in April 1917, the first man in the war to be awarded all three medals, the VC, the MC and the DCM. His official citation for the Victoria Cross from the London Gazette reads, "For most conspicuous bravery and determination, the troops of various units on the left of this officer's battalion had become disorganised owing to the heavy casualties from shell fire and a subsequent determined enemy attack with very strong forces caused further confusion and retirement, closely pressed by hostile forces. Second Lieutenant Pollard at once realised the seriousness of the situation and dashed up to stop the retirement. With only four men, he started a counter-attack with bombs and pressed it home till he had broken the enemy attack, regained all that had been lost, and much ground in addition. The enemy retired in disorder, sustaining many casualties. By his force of will, dash and splendid example, coupled with an utter contempt of danger, this officer, who had already won the DCM and MC, infused courage into every man who saw him." Now, I mentioned Pollard in the previous podcast about Great War memoirs. I'm holding a copy of his book, Fire Eater, The Memoirs of a VC, now, and this is his account of the action. "Knowing the Huns' little ways, I expected to be counterattacked as soon as he'd rallied his troops. I at once started putting my strong point in a condition of defence. The fusilier with us knew nothing of bombs, so I stationed him on the lookout beside the barricade. We furnished him with seven rifles, some Hun and some British, all fully loaded. Even then, I could not help thinking of Robinson Crusoe's similar preparations. The rest of us collected all the bombs we could find. Fortunately, the trench was well provided, though, of course, all the bombs were German. Strange though it may seem, I was glad of this. One can throw a German bomb further than a British. The reason for this is quite a simple one. The Hun bomb is a canister full of high explosive on the end of a short stick. It relies for its accomplishment mostly on moral effect. It weighs 1 pound. The Mills bomb, on the other hand, is designed to do considerable damage when it bursts. It consists of a serrated cast iron body filled with 2.5 ounces of ammonol. It weighs 1.5 pounds. One can throw 1 pound weight with a stick to act as a lever very much further than one can throw 1.5 pounds of dead weight. Certainly the Mills bomb is a much superior weapon when it happens to explode in a trench, but in the excitement of a bombing attack, the vast majority fall on the top or outside of the parapet. The greater noise of the Hun canister when exploding has a far greater effect in the long run than a few more dangerous Mills bombs which fall on their objective. It was less than 10 minutes before the Huns returned. When they came, they were determined to retrieve the ground they had lost. I could tell that by the vigour of their attack. Right from the first, bombs fell thick and fast. We replied with as good as we received. I threw off my tin hat to give my arms better play for throwing. Next went my gas mask. Bang, 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 bang. The air was thick with bombs going and coming. Those that fell in the trench, we flung over the parapet before they had time to explode. My two companions were magnificent. Our fusilier friend protected our front. And Pollard goes on to describe how he then brought up Lewis guns and rifle grenades, and in this combined effect, using all the weapons in his arsenal, and even only having a small number of men, he was able to beat off that superior German counterattack and superior German forces and win the day and hold his ground, thus the award of the Victoria Cross. So again, it's great to be able to relate what's in memoirs like that to the ground as it is today. From here, we make our way through the village, come to a road junction and turn off where there was an old cafe on the corner. I'm not sure if it's still there in the post-COVID world. There are some famous photographs from the Phoney War period of 1939-40 of British troops marching up and down through the village of Gavrelle, and a universal carrier being followed by troops coming down past where this cafe was. But we're not here to talk about the next Great War. We're going to continue up this road to take us to the northern side of the village, out towards where the infamous Gavrelle windmill was located. And here we'll look at the story of the Royal Marines. As we walk away from the village of Gavrelle on the road that would take you to the next village, Oppy, we pass under two bridges that carry the fast road to and from the motorway to Arras. And we emerge into quite a deep cutting, almost a sunken road. And as it moves further towards Oppy, and we can see the church spire in the distance, and there's a big electrical substation just before Oppy Wood, just up ahead on the left-hand side. Long before we get to that, as we come out of this sunken bit, a track goes off to the right that takes us out to the edge of the fields. And you can continue along a track that runs parallel to the fast road and then curves off a bit past a pylon out into the fields. And in this area, you're very close to the site of the Gavrelle windmill. Now, windmills are only built on high points, and from here you can see quite a distance up towards Oppy, back towards the villages of Ballyhull, back towards Arras, across the open rolling ground towards the motorway area in the areas that are on the kind of eastern fringe of the battlefields of Arras. So it's no surprising that from here there's a good view on a site where there was once a windmill. And most of the windmills in this part of northern France were stone towers with the sails of the windmill on them. And I'm not sure whether it was still a working windmill in 1914, but of course, even by the time of the Battle of Arras, before it began, it was a target for enemy artillery, Allied artillery, first the French and then the British, and most likely it was in some kind of ruinous state. And then the terrific fighting that took place here in April 1917 destroyed it even more. I did find one photograph of the ruins of the structure in the history of the 47th London Division, who occupied this sector in late 1917 before they moved off to take part in fighting elsewhere along the Hindenburg line in the Battle of Cambrai. And I'll put that onto the podcast website. But here we're overlooking fields that connect us to the next phase of the Royal Naval Division's battle here in April of 1917. And we've discussed the army battalions in the division, the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve battalions named after admirals, and what we've got here is a part of the battlefield that connects us to the two Royal Marine battalions that were in the division. Now, we mentioned in the very formation of the Royal Naval Division in 1914, they drew in men from the Royal Marine Light Infantry, and they were drawn from the different depots where those Royal Marines trained: Portsmouth, Plymouth, Chatham and Deal. And when you look at the records of Royal Marine soldiers in the Great War, you see that they have those names often abbreviated. So Plymouth is PLY and Portsmouth is PO. We see those very much part of their identity, really, because that's where they trained, that was their depot, and that was their kind of place, I guess, in the story and the history of the Royal Marines at that time. And while they fought as individual units in the early stage of the Royal Naval Division, by the time of the Western Front, by the time the division came to the Western Front, they'd formed these two Royal Marine battalions. So you could have a mixture of men from different Royal Marine depots serving side by side in some of these units. But nevertheless, these two Royal Marine battalions were key elements within the Royal Naval Division. Now, the Royal Marines at the time of the First World War were not really the Royal Marines. They were broken up into different parts of what the Royal Marines were and what they did. Their principal duty was to serve at sea on naval vessels as part of the establishment of those ships. And at the time that the war broke out in 1914, there were two key branches of the Royal Marines: the Royal Marine Light Infantry, and they were the men that fought, as the name suggests, as infantry, and the Royal Marine Artillery, who would man guns, often on ships. But when the war broke out, the Royal Marine Light Infantry were used as ground troops as part of the Royal Naval Division. Royal Marine Light Infantry also continued to be used at sea, and men from that unit took part in all of the major naval engagements of the First World War. And the Royal Marine Artillery was used to man some of the bigger calibre guns on the Western Front. There's a famous sequence of film that was taken in the preparation for the Battle of the Somme that became part of the Battle of the Somme film in 1916 that shows a 15-inch howitzer being prepared and then firing. And the men operating those weapons are wearing a slightly different kind of uniform. When you look at it closely, it's naval Macintoshes that they're wearing rather than British Army issue rain capes. So they are men from the Royal Marine Artillery that were manning some of those heavy, some of the heaviest guns used on that sector of the Western Front at that stage of the war. And by the end of the war, another branch of the Royal Marines had been formed, one of the lesser known aspects of Royal Marine history, and that was the Royal Marine Labour Corps, a unit that was formed to carry out labour duties recruited from Royal Marines who were not fit to serve either in the Royal Marine Artillery or in the Royal Marine Light Infantry in a frontline capacity. And I think that was the only time in its history that the Royal Marines had a unit like that. So the Royal Marines, a unit that we, you know, most closely associate with the war at sea, was actually very much a part of the war on the Western Front. And we see that reflected in the cemeteries and memorials as we travel from the Somme to here at Arras, up to Passchendaele, and right through to the battlefields at the end of the conflict. So we see evidence of them pretty much everywhere we go. But here at Gavrelle, it's an important part of their core history, because in these fields where we're standing now, in this place where the Gavrelle windmill once stood, was the most costliest corner of a foreign field or any kind of battlefield, whether at land or sea, that the Royal Marines experienced in their entire history. So more Royal Marines became casualties here in a single day than any other in its history. Now, there are some conflicting figures for this, but the accepted one is something like 846 Marines were killed, wounded, or missing here in the battle of the 28th of April 1917. Most of the dead, when we look at the dead, most of them are commemorated on the Arras Memorial, which is the main memorial to the missing for this part of the battlefield. So when we stand in this field, it is still potentially the grave of many of those men who died in that most fatal battle that the Royal Marines ever took part in. The Royal Marine attack went in here. Those two battalions of Royal Marine Light Infantry went into the assault, as we've said, on the 28th of April 1917 as part of the continued attack on the positions north of Gavrelle. In the early phase of the fighting, the Naval Division had captured the ground to the west and the south, the bulk of the village, but that area above the main road was still in German hands as it moved towards that neighbouring village of Oppy. So in this operation, the advance ran parallel to the main road to capture those German trenches in this northern part of the Gavrelle battlefield. and the two Royal Marine battalions were the ones detailed to do this. They were essentially kind of trying to straighten out the line here and push the advance forward. The attack began at 4:25 in the morning, and the 1st Royal Marine Battalion went in on the boundary line with a neighbouring division as they were fighting up towards Oppie and Oppie Wood. The wire, as was common in these battles around Gavrelle, was largely uncut, but they got into the German positions, although later they were repulsed by counterattacks. The casualties were so heavy in that 1st Royal Marine Battalion that one account says that they were never heard of again, which I suspect is a little bit of an exaggeration, but it shows the level of the casualties, which we'll return to those figures shortly. The 2nd Royal Marine Battalion then went into the south of the 1st, and they took the area very close to where we're standing now, around this Gavrelle windmill site. And despite similar problems with uncut wire and the German positions, they did get into the windmill and they did capture it and hold it. The Germans counterattacked once the Royal Marines had taken this position around the windmill. It was very common for the Germans to almost immediately counterattack once ground had been taken. And we see that a lot in these battles on the Western Front in the First World War, particularly in these later stages from the Somme through to the end of the conflict. But a small party of Marines within the ruins of this windmill, which wasn't very big, held on despite these counterattacks, despite being pretty much surrounded by the German forces. And they remained in that state until a link-up with other Royal Naval Division units was possible late on in that day. But at one stage, a party of just 40 men from the Royal Marine Light Infantry held off something like 13 different German counterattacks. So it was very much a page in the annals of the history of the Royal Marines in terms of bravery, in terms of service, in terms of the highest traditions, really, of the Royal Marines. And when we look at the casualties that were suffered, the 1st Royal Marine Battalion lost over 500 men, and the 2nd Royal Marine Battalion was known to have lost 10 officers and over 200 men killed. I've not been able to find an accurate figure for their wounded. And when we look at the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, using their website, you can go on to the search part of it and you can put in Royal Marines and the date 28th of April 1917, and it'll come up with a list of men that were killed that day, some at sea and other engagements unconnected with this, but it gives us a figure of well over 300 Royal Marine Light Infantry men killed that day, of which the vast majority, as we've said, are commemorated on the Arras Memorial to the Missing. So when you go to that in the Faubourg d'Amiens Cemetery on the western side of the city of Arras, and you go to those naval names right at the beginning of the memorial on panel one, you'll see Royal Marines there, and the vast majority of them are men killed in this action here at the Gavrelle windmill on the 28th of April 1917. There are a few in the battlefield cemeteries. There's a concentration cemetery up the road called Orchard Dump, and there are some identified soldiers buried in there, quite a lot of unknown Royal Marines that were possibly recovered from this site after the war. But certainly I don't think it matches anywhere near the number of missing. As we've said, like so many parts of the Western Front battlefields, a field like this is still potentially a grave. So once again, as we pause for reflection and look out across what is really an insignificant little field alongside a road, a fast road in northern France, this though, for past and present and hopefully future members of the Royal Marines, remains hallowed ground, sacred ground, and echoes that brave tradition that the Royal Marines stand for, as we've said, when we think of the acts of gallantry and the sacrifice that was made here during the Battle of Arras in 1917. And most people, as I say, will kind of think of the Royal Marines being at sea and the Battle of Jutland, when so many ships were sunk, on them Royal Marines doing their duty, who went down with the rest of the crew. But even more Royal Marines died here than in the Battle of Jutland. So it is a greatly significant and perhaps lesser known battlefield involving Marines from the Great War. So we'll walk away from this hallowed ground now back into the village of Gavrel, pass under those two bridges again, go past that little cafe and the church, and head out to the southern part of the village, which will take us out to our final stop, the cemetery, and in the fields just the other side of the village of Gavrel. As you emerge from the last few houses of the village of Gavrel on a road that would take you to the village to the south of here, to Fampoo, you come to the last house on the right, and there's a track heading out across the fields, and you'll see a green Commonwealth War Graves Commission sign there for Naval Trench Cemetery. And you can follow that track. It takes you out into these vast fields that surround the village. You get a sense of the landscape once more, how open it is, and you can look back on the village at different points to get a different perspective from this side of Gavrel. And you're looking really right through the path of the advance of the Royal Naval Division in that early attack on the 23rd of April 1917. And beyond it, beyond the church, beyond the fast road, is where you've just come from, where the Gavrel windmill was, where the men of the Royal Marine Light Infantry were fighting. As we come up towards the cemetery, we can see that it's not one of these vast, silent cities with thousands of graves. It's a small battlefield burial site, a small battlefield cemetery. In many ways, a comrade cemetery, because the men buried in it are bound together by comradeship, having served in the same formations. And it's very small. There's only 59 original burials here from the Great War, and one additional World War II burial that was made from the fighting in this area in May 1940. The name of the cemetery, Naval Trench Cemetery, is taken from the names given to the German trenches on this part of the Gavrel battlefield that were captured and then later used by the Royal Naval Division. So when people like Joe Murray fought their way through the village and Arthur Asquith's men took that ground, this became an area behind their forward positions, and this is where they set up a battalion and unit headquarters, and there was also a regimental aid post here, so the wounded would be brought back from the forward posts and then treated by the medical officer here and then taken back further for treatment if required. But of course many men were brought in with fatal wounds and died and were buried here, and this is how, almost certainly, how this cemetery began. But what does the cemetery, what does Naval Trench Cemetery represent? Looking at the name, you'd think it was a Battle of Gavrel Cemetery, that the men from the Royal Naval Division, Royal Naval Volunteer Reservists, men from the Army Battalions and the Royal Marines would be buried in here, and it would be their burial site for their dead, for the capture and the holding of the ground at Gavrel. But it's not. It's actually a later cemetery, post-battle, established after the village, after the fight of the windmill was over. And when we look at the records, it's not just the Royal Marines who had so many men who were missing. The majority of the Royal Naval Volunteer Reservists and other units within the division, they're dead from those two main attacks, the 23rd, 28th of April 1917. They're commemorated on the Arras Memorial with no known grave. So what we've got here is a battlefield cemetery made after the capture of the village and then used when units were in the front line on the eastern and the northern side of the village. And when men were killed there or evacuated back here and died of their wounds, this is where they were buried. And the dead are not just from the Royal Naval Division. There are in fact two main divisions represented by the casualties when we look at the cap badges as we walk along the ranks of the graves of the men who are here. The Royal Naval Division, of course, is the most obvious one when we see naval badges and Royal Marine Light Infantry badges, but the other one is the 47th London Division. Now, I mentioned that I had a photograph of the Gavrel windmill that comes from their divisional history, and as part of the research from this, and I'm looking up at the volume now, I took down the red divisional history that covers the story of the 47th London Division on the Western Front from 1915 until the end of the war. And I looked up the chapter connected to Gavrel, because I don't think I'd immediately connected them with this area. But they were here for a very short period before they moved on to another battle. And we'll say a little bit more about that shortly. But what we're looking at here are not men killed going over the top in attacks or big operations. These are men killed holding the line in the day-to-day activities of trench warfare. So it reflects not the main Battle of Arras, but the outcome of it, the stabilisation of the line here, and the return to, in inverted commas, normality as the front becomes static once more. When we look at the casualties that are buried in here, there are two from the fighting at Gavrelle itself. Two Royal Naval Division men who were killed in and around the village during the actual battle, who I suspect their bodies were found later on and then brought in here for burial. This wasn't uncommon, and perhaps even some men during the fighting had hastily buried their mates, knew where they were buried, and when they got an opportunity, they went out there, recovered the bodies, and they brought them into this decent burial ground to be properly buried here. We'll probably never discover the story of how these men were found and buried, but they're buried side by side. When we look at the Royal Naval Division casualties that are in here, there were two that kind of sprung off the page to me. One of those was a Royal Marine officer, Lieutenant Austin Pugh Cook, who joined the Royal Marine Light Infantry in 1915. He served with them at Gallipoli, and then he was posted to a trench mortar battery. So even in the Royal Naval Division, they had machine gun and trench mortar units. He went to a trench mortar, a brigade level trench mortar battery with Stokes mortars, and he trained on those. And during one of the training exercises, once they got to France, he was accidentally wounded by the premature explosion of a Stokes mortar round. Whether it was dropped or misfired in the barrel, I don't know, but he was wounded. And then afterwards he rejoined the Royal Marine Light Infantry and was killed at Gavrelle during a quiet period in July of 1917. From Haverford West, he was born there in 1893. He'd studied classics at St David's University. And there's quite a nice memorial page from their website with a photograph of him on there. Again, when you kind of look at these stories and you research these men, you ask yourself, you know, what kind of what-ifs are they? What would they have gone on to achieve? What would his life have been if he'd been just wounded here and survived the Great War? I guess that's what we think about every time we come to cemeteries like this. Buried not far away is Corporal William Marsden, MM. He was a veteran Royal Marine. He joined the Royal Marine Light Infantry in September 1914 as a wartime volunteer, being a miner from Worksop in Nottinghamshire. Quite a few miners seem to have joined the Royal Marines. It's a curious thing. In Barnsley, when I was living there, I discovered that there was a whole group of men who ended up in the Royal Marine Light Infantry at Gallipoli and on the Western Front. And thanks to podcast listener Neil York, I was able to see some fantastic research on them, which I do hope will be published one day. So it's interesting that men who joined a unit like the Royal Marines didn't necessarily have a kind of naval connection. Marsden was then posted on enlistment to the Portsmouth Division of the Royal Marine Light Infantry and became, of course, part of the Royal Naval Division. He was wounded twice at Gallipoli, the first time on the 28th of April, just a few days after the landings in 1915, most likely with a detachment that was sent up to Anzac alongside the Australians. He was then later wounded twice in France and killed with the 2nd Royal Marine Battalion on the 16th of September 1917, having survived the Gavrelle windmill episode. So he'd gone through that battle there, been one of the handful of men to survive, only to be killed in a quiet sector. Sadly, that story is all too common when we study the Great War. And it does appear that the military medal that's on his headstone and in the register entry for him was awarded for bravery at the Gavrelle windmill. So he might well have been one of those men, one of those 40 that beat off all those German counterattacks. We've mentioned two members of the Royal Marine Light Infantry, part of the Royal Naval Division. So we've got to mention one of the Royal Naval Volunteer Reservists. And going back to those two men who were actually killed in the fighting in Gavrelle village or around it, one of them buried here, Petty Officer George Thompson Hall, MM, of the Hawk Battalion, Royal Naval Division, was an arc lamp trimmer from North Shields near Newcastle and served in the Tyneside Division of the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve. A lot of Tynesiders, including Joe Murray, joined that unit in the early phase of the war and ended up serving with the Royal Naval Division at Gallipoli and on the Western Front. George Hall enlisted in 1915 and he was posted to France as a post-Somme reinforcement. So the casualties that the Royal Naval Division had suffered in the Ancre Valley at Beaucourt, he went over as a, in a replacement draft to replace them once the Battle of the Somme was over. And his military medal was awarded for the operations on the Ancre because they remained in that sector on the heights above Beaucourt towards Ballascourt Farm during that cold winter of 1916-17. And in the operations they took part in up there, that's what he was awarded his military medal for. And then he was killed in the fighting for Gavrel village on the second day of operations on the 24th of April 1917, aged 27. And he's buried next to a fellow Tynesider killed in the same operation who was from South Shields. So you've got the River Tyne, North Shields to the north, obviously, and South Shields to the south, and two men from both those communities buried side by side here at the Naval Trench Cemetery. It seems quite fitting to me in many ways. Now, we mentioned that the 47th London Division was the other formation represented by the burials in this small cemetery. And when we look at the cap badges of the units from that division that are in here and the dates, we see it's from yet another static period of static trench warfare. The division had been posted to this sector to prepare the Gavrel positions for the coming winter. And their divisional history, the divisional history of the 47th London Division, which I mentioned, which is a really good one, very good old comrades association again, that leads to this really good and useful divisional history that they published after the war. It gives a good description of what this part of the line was like at that time. The trench system taken over by the division was an extensive one. Dug deep in the rich loam some distance down from the forward slope, it required an enormous amount of labour for its maintenance in winter. The system adopted in the line was that of a series of defended localities, strong posts from half a mile to three quarters of a mile apart, garrisoned at first by platoons and intended when finished to be garrisoned by companies. The gaps in the line of posts were covered by artillery and machine gun fire from the rear. Orders were issued that no attempt should be made to maintain lateral communicating trenches between these posts, the necessary labour and material not being available. About half a mile in the rear of the posts ran the line built by our predecessors, and known as the Naval and Marine Trenches, while behind that again lay the Red Line. In rear of this rose a prominent ridge between Balliol village, which made it possible for our forward areas and the enemy trenches to be under complete observation. While the system of forward posts certainly enabled work to be concentrated with a gain in time, labour and material, it had the disadvantage of affording a series of admirable targets to the enemy artillery and trench mortars, especially in the case of these posts, situated on commanding and consequently relatively high ground, as for instance Mill Post, or those forming a distinct salient in the line of posts, as for instance Bradford Post. This system was no doubt only intended to be employed during the winter months, a modern version of the old-time winter quarters, and as such it possessed not only the advantage of economy of forces already referred to, but had the added advantage of practicing all ranks in the infantry units in constant patrolling in the open or semi-open between the posts. So what we're hearing there in that approach to the winter of 1917, and a few weeks later the 47th London Division pulled out and went off to fight at Bourlon Wood, is that you're seeing a kind of legacy that they left behind that the other London Division, the 56th London Division, inherited when they defended this sector in March 1918. You can see how the isolated posts that we've spoken about and that were referred to in that account, the construction of them, that led to this position that could be kind of held together by these posts, but also potentially made it vulnerable if the Germans outflanked them. So the London lads who were buried here died in that quiet labouring period before their surviving comrades went off to take part in the next big battle. And they handed these positions over to units from the 31st Division, a POWs division with the Accrington POWs and the Barnsley POWs and the Bradford POWs and the Leeds POWs, Sheffield City Battalion and so on, who then spent some months here during that winter of 1917-18. They'd been previously fighting up around Oppy and Oppy Wood and in front of the village of Ballyhill. So this became a big sector, really, between Gavrell and Oppy for those Powell's battalions. And many men who had been wounded on the Somme at Serre on the 1st of July or in the second attack in November 1916 had recovered to then return here and serve on this front, being killed or wounded, or quite a lot of them got trench fever, trench sickness from serving on this part of the front during that winter period. So it's an interesting cemetery where we can see a commonality between the men buried here, and we see a true comrade cemetery with men from particular formations buried side by side. And as we stand here in this small battlefield cemetery, surrounded by the badges of the naval and marine infantry who won these fields and held them in 1917, we look back across to the Pont du Jour, where it all began here at Arras, across the modern village of Gavrelle, a quiet corner of these Arras battlefields, but rich in so much history, so many stories, and where we find a place where a high price was paid by those who bore the globe and laurel, their special corner of the old front line. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCorps. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.